So on to item six, presentation from Siegel Consulting regarding the December 31st, 2019 valuation. So Gail, were you going to introduce this or should we go right to Siegel?
Yes, I'll just say briefly, we have Paul Angelo and Andy Young here today from Siegel Consulting. They have finished the December 31st, 2019 actual evaluation report, which they'll be presenting today.
Great. Thank you, Gail. Great. Paul and Andy, welcome, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Paul Angelo. Unfortunately, I'm having difficulty with my computer microphone and my computer camera, so I'm not hiding from you, but that's why I can't show you my my image here. But you see Andy Young is there. We will be discussing today the December 31, 2019 actual evaluation and review, and Andy's going to be driving the slides there, and I will be doing most of the color commentary. So I don't know if you have your own copies, but assuming that you're just working from what you see on the screen, Andy, let's just jump a couple pages forward to page 5. We'll just be here for a moment. This is where we recite the purpose and the basis for the valuation. If you go to the next page, it has a nice quick summary of where you can find how we pay off the unfunded liability. We will talk about that in more detail. But really, the meat of the report starts on the next page, on page 7. So, and if you're familiar with our actual report from past years, we have here a text that shows a valuation highlight. I'm going to get that out. Oops, don't do that. Okay.
Paul, can you hang on a second? Is there any way we can go to the full screen? It's enough of an eye chart this way.
Yeah. So, Andy, can you make that any bigger?
I can try.
I don't know about you.
That's better. Does that get it?
That's better. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. It helps me too. So if you're familiar with our actual reports from past years and the valuation highlights, we talk through each of the main results of the year in text. And then on the left column there, you'll see a series of references. And that's where we can find more details on each of the items. Now, this was really a very straightforward valuation. There's a bullet later that talks about the fact that this is the first time that we show the deep pooling of East Fon Air from Con Fire. So rate group 8 is now only going to be Contra Costa Fire, and we have a new rate group 13, which now is East Contra Costa Fire. We'll see that in a moment. But other than that, it was a fairly routine valuation. Your funded ratio here improved slightly from 99.3 to 90.6, and that's on a smooth value basis. On a market value basis, you actually had a good year in market, so your funded ratio went from 84.2 up to about 92. And then we always like to walk through how did the unfunded liability change from last year to this year. So we're going to do our first of two main jumps into the body of the report. So you see there on the left where it says page 30. So Andy, I'm going to ask you to race down to page 30 for us, and then we will look at what we call the reconciliation. I call it the reconciliation. It calls it the development of the unfunded actual accrued liability. And I do want to pause occasionally, Mr. Chairman. You know, once I get ahead of steam up, I'll just keep talking. So are there any questions thus far before we get into sort of how we got from last year to this year? I just want to pause and let the trustees comment if they'd like to.
Okay.
Looks like we're seeing none. Okay. So there are two really informative pages in an actual report. This one gets us from last year's unfunded liability of $1,031 to this year's unfunded liability of $920, $919. And the way this works is each year you accrue another year of normal cost, which is the cost allocated to the current year of service for your active members. You incur administrative expenses, which we put here on an expected basis. And then we have the expected contributions, which have to pay the normal cost. They pay interest on the accrued liability and the normal cost. I said that wrong. Interest on the unfunded liability and the normal cost. And whatever's left goes to reduce the principal balance of your unfunded liability. Well, you can see here, if all assumptions came true, your unfunded would have gone from $1,031,000,000 down to about $919,000,000. And what that means is you are in positive amortization territory. Yeah, we had a lot of discussion back in 2012 when you reset your funding policy about avoiding what's called negative amortization. So this is clearly positive amortization. The expected contributions under your funding policy will cover the normal cost of $240,000,000. It covers interest on the unfunded and the normal cost of about $65,000,000, with enough left over to drop your unfunded from $1,031,000,000 down to $918,000,000. Well, of course, that's what happens if nothing surprising happens. No gains and losses, no changes of any type. But of course, there are always things that happen other than assumed. You did have a rate of return even after smoothing less than the expected. We'll see that in another bullet. That increased your unfunded liability by about $65 million. You had actual contributions greater than expected. You had a gain from additional unfunded contributions. You had individual salary increases higher than expected. That's good for the members, but it increases your liabilities. Your COLA is less than expected. That's a little tough on the members, but it reduces your liabilities. Then we have an other item there of about $36 million. And if you can scroll down just a scooch, I think we have a footnote that talks through that, but I think it's just miscellaneous items. Let's see here. So you see, it really is all the other demographic assumptions, mortality, retirement, disability, et cetera. And then we have here item G, a method change. This is a fairly narrow refinement to the way that we allocate the cost to different years of service. And I'm going to ask Andy to talk about the details in a moment. I believe this is one of the items that was identified in your actuarial audit. So, Andy, if you can just, I think it's mentioned in a bullet. Why don't you just give us a couple sentences on that, if you would?
Yeah, absolutely. So this has to do with our members who came to work for us from another reciprocal agency. The idea is that it doesn't really change the total present value of benefit that the member is expected to draw from CSERA. However, it does change the allocation of that present value, same present value of benefit between future normal cost and accrued liability. So it reduced the accrued liability, which is a good thing for the plan. But when Paul goes through the reconciliation of the employer rate, you will see a small uptick in the employer rate because we are changing the allocation of that same present value among normal cost and accrued liability.
Very good. And this really is, you know, all systems use what's called the entry age method, but there are little refinements within that method. And again, we were appreciative of the actual audit because we agreed that this was a suggestion worth making. So then that gets us to the new actual unfunded of about $947 million. Again, because we had roughly net $28 million of unexpected items. And as you can see from the list there, the two dominant ones are the investment return and the individual salary increases. And then the next largest one is really all the other demographic stuff mushed together, which was the gain here of $36 million. So, absent any questions on this page, now normally we would jump back to, but don't go there, Andy, go back to page six, and the next bullet talks about the change in the employer rate. But because it's a little tricky to do that here on the screen, Andy, why don't we just go show down to the next page. Page 31 shows how we calculate the recommended employer contribution. But I'm really going to focus on the next page, which is page 32. And what we have here is just as what we saw before was how we got from last year's unfunded to this year's unfunded. Now we're going to see how we get from last year's aggregate employer contribution rate, which was 35.73, how do we get to this year's aggregate employer contribution rate, which is almost the same, 35.66. Now, I always like to stress, there is no one in the plan for whom the contribution rate is exactly 35.73 or 35.66. This is averaged over all of your cost groups, all of your tiers, all your employers. So it's a good way of seeing in the large how the employer contribution rate has changed. And when I said at the beginning, this is a fairly dull valuation, when you have that average employer contribution rate only move about, what is that, about 7 basis points. That's what we call level cost. But, of course, there's a lot happening under the hood, right? So let's look and see. Most of the items that we saw when we reconciled the unfunded liability, they will also show up here, plus some new ones. So the first one there, we saw that there was a loss, I think it was about $60 million expected return being less than the assumed return. When you take that additional unfunded, amortize it over your 18-year period. Did I get that right, Andy? 18 years?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, amortize it over 18 years and divide it by payroll, it's about 54 basis points, about 0.5%. So for this year and the next 17 years, your employer rate will include an additional 54 basis points just to fund the actuarial loss that was recognized in this year's valuation. Actual contributions greater than expected was a gain. UAL contributions was a gain. Again, all translated down to percentage of pay. Here's the individual salaries increasing higher than expected. That was the second largest loss item. But now we see something we didn't see before. When salaries grow faster than expected, the unfunded liability payments in dollars are now spread over a larger payroll. So we did not see this on the unfunded page. This isn't that the unfunded got bigger. This is that the unfunded is being spread over a larger than expected payroll. That makes the rate go down by, Andy, you can circle it there, that 26 basis points that you see. The next one we did see before, COLAs increased lower than expected, again, in terms of a cost change at 79 basis points. Now, here's another one that we did not see on the unfunded page. This is the effect of changes in member demographics on normal costs. What does that mean? Well, as you know, CSERA has the legacy tiers and it has the PEPRA tiers. I'm speaking very generally. Generally speaking, the PEPRA tiers are less generous in terms of benefits. And so over time, as members retire from the legacy tiers and are replaced by members in the new PEPRA tiers, that will gradually make your overall normal cost go down. So that's what that 33 basis point decrease is. People ask us sometimes, where do we see the savings from PEPRA? And we tell them, well, it's going to take an entire generation, of course, of workforce before we replace all the legacy benefit members with PEPRA benefit members. But here we see in this 1 year a drop of 33 basis points. Now, there can be other changes in member demographics, but Andy, check me on this. This is primarily that substitution effect from the shift from the legacy tiers to the PEPRA tier.
Yeah, I think, Paul, you're right. For the plan as a whole, we do see some cost group where the normal cost, for example, changes by more than expected because of that change in the entry age under the entry age method Paul was talking about. But all in all, this 33 basis points or about $3 million reduction in the employer's total contribution is primarily as a result of replacing the legacy members by the PEPRA members.
Very good. Then the other thing, you had a small change in the administrative expense load, which we review every year. Then we did have that other gains, which is I think is around $36 million. Again, that gets amortized, and that's reduced rate by about 34 basis points. And then here's that change in method that we talked about before, where we're really just reallocating costs between the accrued liability and the normal cost. You net that all out, you know, it's a lot of talk for 7 basis points, and we have a net reduction in the aggregate employer rate of those 7 basis points. Now, as I say, this one and the sheet we just looked at really is what tells you how we got from last year to this year. So again, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to pause to see if there's any questions from the trustees on either of these two reconciliation pages.
Not seeing anyone light up their mic.
Well, so either I'm doing a great job or I've lost everybody. You never know in this line of work. Probably the former. There we go. Thank you. Andy, let's go to the next page real quick. We do a reconciliation of the average member contribution rate. It's a lot shorter. There are far fewer things that affect the member rate. However, you know, for the legacy tribe, for the PEPRA tiers, the members do pay half of the normal cost. And so there is this change in method did have a small impact on their rate as well. Otherwise, other than that, though, it's really the administrative load. You know, the members do not pay the unfunded liability for the most part. And most of the change in employer costs traced to changes in the unfunded liability, which was the first page we went through. So that's why this is so much shorter. All we really see is the administrative load, shifting the member demographics again, and then the change in method, but all relatively small items, leaving, if I'm reading that right, the aggregate contribution rate for the members was actually unchanged. So just a little bit of fluffle under the surface there. Okay? I think the only other thing I think I'd like to look at is, Andy, why don't we go back to page, go back to the summary page if we would, there where we were on page 7. So at this point, we've looked at page 30, which was that's the second item here. We looked at, we've not gone to page 24 yet. We'll look at that in a second. 32 is where we reconciled the employer rate. 33 was the member rate. So I think the next thing we're going to look at now, since the principal gain loss item here, I'm looking now at item number 3, you see there, the net loss from investments, which was 56.6 million or 0.6 percent of the actual accrued liability. The next principal gains, the others were fairly small. So what I want to do now, you'll see all that item 6 here talks about the rate of return on the market value of assets. So why don't we look at that for a moment, Andy? So let's navigate to page 24. We'll start from there. There we go. So 24 shows the net loss of investments, and you can see that that is mainly, all the gains and losses. You can see here that there was 65.5, and then all the other things met into those two smaller numbers. Let's go to the next page, Andy, to page 25. Now this shows just for 1 year the fact that the rate of return on market value was actually 14.39, which is higher than the assumed rate of 7, but after smoothing, the rate of return on a smooth basis was 6.24, and then that's the same as what we use in evaluation, same rate, and that's because we are recognizing past gains and losses. Now, to see how that works, let's go to page, and which page are we on here now? Just scroll down to the second there.
Okay, page 25.
Yeah, so let's go to page 26, which will have a history of this. And again, we're focusing here on the investment return because that's the main driver of your experience this year. Now, some people like tables and some people like numbers. So here's the table. You can see the rates of return on a market value basis in the last 10 years. It's kind of a roller coaster. We apply our 5-year smoothing, and it still moves around, but it's much less bumpy. And then you can see that's how we get to, for the current year, the 6.24 at the bottom. I really like looking at the graph instead. And so let's go to page 27. This is the very same information on a graphical basis. The green squares there, that's the rate of return on a market value basis. Now, we only show 10 years on the table, but I have insisted that my staff hang on to 2007 because I want people to see the housing crisis and that went into the Great Recession. From 2007, we pretty much earned the assumed rate. 2008, wasn't that a fun year? Nearly a 30% loss, which means actuarially that was like close to a 37% loss because you not only did not earn the assumed rate, but you had an absolute loss. Next year, 2009-19, we had the recovery. So we have green squares on a rate of return basis is the market value roller coaster. The rates of return on a smooth basis follow those general contours. They're just a lot smoother. And this is really why we like to use asset smoothing, because it does produce a more smooth pattern of rates of return and therefore contributions. Now, Andy, I'm going to make you go backwards to page 23.
May I make a comment?
Oh, please do, Andy.
Yeah. The reason why, even though in the legend we saw three values, rate of return being labeled on this graph, but you don't really see a line for the actuarial value. It's only because the two are very close to each other. One is basically overlapping the other. So I just want to make that comment.
Right. Yeah, so if you're looking for the blue diamond, you really got to squint at that orange triangle. There's a little tiny blue diamond hiding behind it. That's how Excel works. The difference between the actuarial value and the valuation value has to do with back in the day when the so-called excess earnings was used to do things like provide employer and member contribution relief. Well, under the board's funding policy, that has not happened in quite a while. So the actuarial value of assets and the valuation value of assets are essentially the same and have been, as you can see here, all the way back to 2007. So the only other thing I want to say about assets moving, here we're seeing the rates of return. Andy, let's go back to page 23 where we can see the market value and the smooth value, but now in dollars. Now the scale is not too helpful here, but you can see here back in 2000, 2007, and 8, when the market value plunged, the smooth value was still recognizing gains from previous years because 2006 and 7 were very strong years. So the smooth value actually continued to stay pretty flat, waiting for the recovery of the market value that we saw in the other one, those high returns in 2009 and 10. Those basically allow the market to pull back up. So this is a great picture of assets moving, doing exactly what it's hired to do. It's just a little more patient, and it allows the ups and downs of the markets to average out. So you can see here very well over this 12-year period, sometimes the smooth value, that's the orange triangle, sometimes it's lower, that's during the good years. And when you have losses, the smooth value is higher, but they tend to do this little dance back and forth, and that's really what asset smoothing is designed to do. And if you go back up one more page, to page 22, this is all, I will not make you go through this, this will not be on the quiz, but this is all the ins and outs of how asset smoothing works. We look at each six-month period, what the expected return was, what the actual return was. We take the difference between the two. That's the amount that gets smoothed over 5 years, but we actually do it in 10 six-month periods. But you can look through here and see when were the good periods and when were the bad periods going back at 5 years, and then that percent deferred is how much is recognized in this valuation each year. So this is all the nuts and bolts that leads to those two different rates of return that we saw on page 27 and the two different values of assets that we saw on page 23. So that's all I'm going to say about assets moving. Now, Mr. Chairman, I have one other topic, which is going to be the how we pay off the unfunded. But let me pause and see if there are any questions about the experience or the assets moving so far.
Yeah. Now, Paul, maybe if I may make a comment, I think when Paul went through the dance between the market value, the actuarial value, he highlighted that there were some years where one is higher and the other one is lower. But in this case, it is very noteworthy that between 2018 and the current valuation is of 2019, the plan has a big swing because if we go back and look at this page from last year, we were actually sitting on over half a billion, $517 million in deferred investment losses in the last valuation. So if the trustees are wondering what happened to the superior market return, because after all, market return was over 14%, over almost 15%. So what happened to those market gains? Because after all, we were only expecting the plan to earn 7%. So in this case, the market gains are actually all spent on beating up or actually mitigating those market losses and building a small amount of deferred investment gain, not a lot, but definitely a huge swing from $517 million loss to $112 million in deferred investment gain this year.
Yeah. Say, Andy, so go to the next page, if you will. We'll see exactly what Andy was just talking about. Look at the last two entries, 2018-2019. In 2018, the market value was lower, so we were deferring losses, and you said about $500 million, right? That's sort of like airing the ice cream. We did the valuation based on more assets than we actually had. That's what happens when you're deferring losses. In 1 year, see how that reversed itself? So now we're deferring gains. That's like rainy day money. So in a single year, 1 year of that positive market return, we only recognize a little bit of it, but that was enough to offset the deferred losses from that in the 2018 valuation and actually put us into a deferred gain, which is what we'd like to be, because that's like rainy day money. So what Andy just described is really those last 2 points. And I know I get all excited about this stuff, but it's that crisscross of asset smoothing. Good years, one goes up, bad years, one goes down, but they're really tracking each other very closely. And I know sometimes critics of public sector pension plans will say all of those public plans, they use these smoothing methods to hide the real value. That's a lie. We are wedded to the market value. We live and die by the market value, but we run it through this little shock absorber in order to deliver a more stable pattern of contribution requirements to your employees. Okay? So I think the only other page I'd like to, Mr. Chairman, I don't know, I didn't ask how much time I had here. Can we cover one more subtopic here? Are we good?
Yes, we're good. Please continue.
Thank you. So Andy, let's jump all the way to the amortization tables, if you would. So they let us see a couple things. Now there's a whole lot of them. I guess they start around page 88 or so. But Andy, to back up just a little bit, I want to show you something that you've never seen before in this actuarial report. Look at this. This is your, right there, Andy, that cost group 13. This is your brand new cost group that was created by action by the board when we de-pooled East Contra Costa Fire from Contra Costa Fire. And what we did was, if you remember, the decision by the board was to allocate the unfunded liability in proportion to liability. And we had two very detailed conversations about that, and I was very pleased we got a unanimous vote on that. So what we did was we actually took the unfunded liability layer by layer and allocated it between this new cost group 13, and then if you have to go back right now, and if you go back to cost group 8, you'll see Confire. That has the rest of this. Andy, where are you going?
Oh, Confire?
Yeah, okay, here we go. Yeah, so again, if you add these two together, you get the amortization that we had from the previous actual report. Now, this is also a chance for us to talk about layered amortization. We can look at any one of these. Let's use this as our example. The board adopted layered amortization back around the 2009 era. And what we did was it was in the 2008 valuation. So we took the 12/31/2007 unfunded liability, both in total and by cost group, and we amortized that or continued amortizing that over a single layer. And then this is when the board adopted 18-year layered amortization. So, for example, in the 2009 there, Andy, the fourth line down, the 2009 valuation, just for COVID-8, there was a net actuarial loss of $25.8 million, $25,785. That is amortized over 18 years. That was 10 years ago, so there's 8 years left. The remaining balance is 19, so of that 25.7, 19 remains. And about $2.8 million will be contributed this year. So what's great about this table is if someone says, so where did the $121 million, $122 million down at the bottom there, outstanding balance, where did that come from? It's like reading the rings on a tree. You can see where every piece of gain or loss, assumption changes, everything that happened to the plan, you can see those all here. The only black box is that restart amortization of about $45 million. That's made of everything that happened prior to 2007. We have plans that have been using, let's say, 15-year layered amortization for 15 years, and that's where you folks will be 3 years from now. And I love that you can actually see where every dollar of unfunded came from. We just happen to be looking at cost group 8 here. And let's now scroll down to the total. We have a grand total after cost group 13. There it is. It might even be two pages. Yeah, it goes on a lot. Now, the thing that we'll notice here, and we saw this back under cost group 8, that in the first couple layers, not only do you have the restart, but there's also some pension obligation bonds that were issued, and you'll notice they have the same initial period and the same years remaining as the restart layer. That's not a coincidence. The pension obligation bond, the amortization of that credit, because after all, if you issue a pension obligation bond, give that money to the plan, that reduces your unfunded liability. So that amortization credit is being amortized over the same period as the restart layer. And so in 3 years from now, both of those will be gone. Now, we have a graphical picture, and this will be my last thing we'll talk about. Let's go to the graphs, Andy. So what we do is, for the plan in total, this is the outstanding balance. The thing about that table we're looking at, that only shows you the current year. It doesn't show you how it's going to roll out over time. Now, this is a little tricky to read. There's a zero line there, and Andy, we could make the zero line a little bit heavier next time, so it's easier to see, but that's it right there. Note on that. Whenever you have a charge, something that increases your unfunded, those are above the zero line. But if you have a credit, something that reduces your unfunded, like an actuarial gain or a pension obligation bond proceeds, that reduces your unfunded. So the black line is the net of the stuff above and the stuff below. And what I'm pointing out here is, you see the orange-looking bars at the top and the bottom? That one up there, that's the restart layer from 2007. And the one down to the bottom, that is the pension obligation bond credit from 2007. And what you can see is, 3 years from now, those will both be fully amortized. Now, here's the cool part. This looks pretty stable, because you can't really tell what the net payment is. So go to the next chart, Andy. Here we see not the outstanding balance going forward, but the net payment. Now, just as before, if you have an actuarial loss, which is in green, or an assumption change, which is in blue, that increases liability, that's a charge, that's above the zero line. Andy, there's a much better zero line here. Why didn't we have a zero line like that back on the previous graph? A little shop talk here. So, but now you can see here how the payments are the net. So look what's going to happen when we get to 2022. Every cost group is going to see a cost reduction because the restart layer will be fully amortized. But the cost groups that also issued pension obligation bonds, there were three of those, they're going to see a cost increase because that credit is no longer available. But you can see net-net, those two will cancel out overall. Now, this is a little bit misleading because this is the whole plan. If you looked at this cost group by cost group, the cost groups that did not issue a pension obligation bond, they'll see a much larger decrease in 2022 because they're not losing that amortization credit. Whereas the three cost groups that did issue a pension obligation bond, their cost change is going to be relatively flat with a slight decrease. So again, this is a little misleading in terms of how it will affect each individual cost group. But we will have, I always think that when we pay off one of these restart layers, we should have a little celebration. Ventura County actually just last year paid off their restart layer because they get 15-year amortization. And we had a little celebration there. I don't want to make light of this. You know, there's a lot of talk about public sector pension costs crowding out resources. Now, you may have heard that phrase in the pension trade. Well, what this shows is that in 2022, it's going to be a little less crowded in Contra Costa County. And that's simply because your employers have paid off a chunk of that unfunded liability. And that's what really is so powerful about this layered amortization. There's always going to be an unfunded because there's always new sources of gain and loss. But you can really see when the employer contributions have actually fully amortized a significant piece of your liability. And that's such a positive note, Mr. Chairman. I will use that as my the point where I will pause our scripted remarks and open to questions and comments. Except, Andy, anything I missed you want to throw in?
No, I think the only thing that I would add, again, very positive note, is that in about 7 to 8 years, the entire UAL would be paid for. So that's also, of course, today when the funding status of the plan will reach 100%. So the fact that we are in air quotes, of course, only at 90% today does not necessarily mean that we would not reach 100% because that would, at least for this plan, would take only a quick 7 or 8 years. So we, again, want to congratulate the board for making that happen.
Because Andy's being a good cop, I have to say that's assuming no future gains and losses, which there will be.
That's
no
right.
Future assumption changes, which there likely will be. So, Andy, don't you dare say that we will be 100% here.
Okay.
I mean, based on the information today,
that's
we
right.
have a projected date of full funding out in 2027. But who knows what will happen between now and then.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. It did look like one of our cost groups has actually paid off the restart of the amortization. Cost group 6 actually has a surplus.
Yeah.
Andy, can we go back and look at that? Will that show on the table here? If you go back to their amortization table?
Yeah. So it's on page 92.
Oh, look at that. Now that's an amortization table. Andy, walk us through that in a little bit.
Yeah, I think, of course, the employers have the option to prepay their unfunded liability ahead of time. I think this is one of those employers that have done that. So that's why the unfunded liability is now zero for that employer.
I think in our reconciliation, Andy, didn't we had an item there. It was only about like $1.3 million, I think, or maybe that was the additional contribution. That's what gets this kind of thing done. Is that right?
Yeah, I think this year we do have two employers who decided to make and are able to make additional contributions. That's right.
Good.
Okay, any trustee questions or comments?
Let me ask this, John, sort of a broad question, maybe 30,000 feet type question. Obviously a very positive report. Where do we stand in assumptions vis-a-vis our other plans, other of the 37 Act plans in particular, of course? Are our assumptions in the lead in terms of being conservative and careful? Are they in the middle? What are the trends that you're seeing out there? How do we compare to that? I realize that's sort of a disjointed question, but I'm looking to your broad knowledge of how we compare to other programs, and is there anything we ought to be concerned about?
Oh, yeah, it's a very good question. Andy, first, give me a quick recitation of, I know that Contra Costa went to some of the more conservative assumptions ahead of others, so give us a quick recitation of where they are, both on the discount rate, expected return, cost of living, and mortality, and then I will put that in a California context.
Absolutely, yeah. The board did a review, and those new assumptions apply starting with not the current, but the last valuation, 2018. So we used the assumptions for 3 years, so this is the second year, so 18, 19, 20, so the assumptions will be applied for one more time before they will be up for review again. So currently, the investment return assumption is at 7%, the price inflation is at 2.75%. So that means the real rate of return, the difference between the two is at 4.25%. At the last experience study, we have already gone to the so-called generational mortality table. And that's basically the prevailing practice among public plans. We are also using the public sector table. So at least as far as mortality assumption is concerned, or we are hoping that our retirees will continue to live longer and getting more payments from the plan, but that's already anticipated as part of the move to the generational mortality. So I think as far as our mortality table is assumption is concerned, again, hopefully our retirees will continue to live longer, but even if that's the case, I think it's already anticipated.
Right. And then as far as the expected return and the inflation, you may remember in the previous study, there was a review where we were still recommending the 3% price inflation, but Contra Costa ahead of the pack went to the 2.75. Right now, that 7% nominal return, 2.75 price inflation is definitely the center of the pack. We have, at least for our systems, we have two systems that have gone to 6.75 with the 2.75 price inflation. So they have a real return of only 4. That's because they have different asset allocations than Contra Costa. So there's two systems that are at 2 of our systems that are at 6.75. And then we have one system, Orange County, was actually went to 2.5% price inflation. Just like Contra Costa, two studies ago, sort of went ahead of Siegel's usual recommendation. This year, Orange County has done that. So Orange County, Andy, I believe, was at 7% and 2.5%, which means they actually have a slightly higher real return of 4.5%. So, Mr. Phillips, you're right in the pack. I think that we're probably not completely done with this. I think that it is likely, not certain, but likely, that Siegel will be moving to a 2.5% price inflation, you know, in future years. That's what we're seeing more and more recommended in actual audits, that kind of thing. So there could be downward pressure for one more click on the dial, as I like to say, one 25 basis point click. But I think you're in a very you're rock solid on the mortality, and I think that on the demographics you're certainly compared to the country. California always leads the country, but even in California, you're comfortably in the pack. But we could see some more downward pressure on that inflation component of 275. John, does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Welcome.
Any other questions?
I see a hand over there.
For Andy. Andy, this is Mike. Could you go back to page 12? I was really surprised at myself of how much of this I understood, but I ran into one spot on page 12 that I need some clarification. Okay, when it gets to the total rate on there, you've got all those percentages and it comes down to 11.9%. Or I don't understand how we came up to the 11.97 out of all those percentages.
And I think it's the weighting by salary, but you want to go ahead and walk them through it?
Yeah. So what we have to do is for the general members where we have most of our members and therefore the salary, what we did was to take a look at their contribution rate and their contribution dollars, and then which are lower than the 11.97. And then we take into account for our safety members, their contribution rates are higher than the average of 11.97. But their payroll dollars are relatively less compared to the general membership. So we add all the contributions together, came up to $112 million. And then we divide that by the total payroll base, which is about $937 million. And so that's how we came up with the 11.97. I think the comment that Paul made at the introduction of the presentation was there's really no employee in the plan which is paying an average contribution rate of the 35.66%. So likewise, in this particular case, there are really no members in particular that is paying a rate of 11.97 because this is, after all, still an average. Some members, an observation well made, that for some members, especially our general members, their rates are coming in less than the average, whereas for our safety members, it is greater than the average, but it just worked out that the average out to about 11.97.
Good. Yeah, I just wasn't getting the fact that you have all those various percentages and none of it should be into the 15. It looks like the 15%, but that's a good explanation. Thank you. It makes sense now.
Thank you.
And so, Mr. Stone, what's a little misleading here, Andy, and then again, this is how we format the report. It looks like 1197 is only the average of the safety, just because of different colors. Mm-hmm. That 1197 is an average all the way up. And it has the tens up there.
Yeah.
You know, it would almost be helpful, Andy. I don't know if we've ever done this. Mm-hmm. Can you go back one page for the employer rate to see if we see the same phenomenon?
Right.
It's not as clear here. But for the member rates, there's such a clear differentiation, Mr. Sloan, between the general and the safety. That gets lost. You'd almost need to have, and let's go back to the next page again.
You almost need to have a subtotal. If you had a subtotal right under cost group 6, which was a general subtotal, that's going to be around 11.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a subtotal of safety, that's going to be, you know, 16, 17.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you weight those two together, and remember the general payroll is much greater than safety, that's how it gets to the 1197.
Mm-hmm.
But the main one that's leading is that it's not clear the 1197 includes the general rates, which are less than 1197.
Good. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Paul and Andy, I wanted to ask you about the impact of terminal pay. So this was a recent development, and then how that's going to impact Sisera going forward. So for decades, thousands of employees have paid extra pension contributions to help cover the cost of terminal pay, counting as pensionable income. That was also true of call pay. So recently, the California Supreme Court struck down the eligibility of terminal pay and call pay from being pensionable income for legacy employees. So going forward, this will mean for lower pension payments by Sisera for these affected employees. Plus, we don't know if the employees or the sponsor will be made whole for the excess pension contributions that have been paid over the years towards terminal and call pay. So it's my understanding that Siegel has accounted for this over the years regarding terminal pay for legacy employees in its calculations and projections. And so how is the recent California Supreme Court ruling going to impact the unfunded liability for Sisera going forward?
So Andy, before we tell them that we actually don't know yet, can we go in the section 4 where we have all the assumptions? And find a page where we have that terminal pay assumption. I'm scrolling through my copy to see if I can find it. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, I think it's on page 117.
117. Right? So hang on, everybody. Here we go. So, now, again, this is, as observed by the comment, you know, we have a valuation assumption to anticipate these leave cash outs. As you might imagine, we are eagerly listening to discussions on what's called the Alameda decision. Whenever they're discussed, they just had a four-hour discussion of the Alameda decision of Ventura County retirement just this Monday. But, Andy, at this point, I think that we are still in a wait and see. So can you walk us through first, is there anything about Alameda in this valuation? I'm going to guess the answer is no. And then what's the status of our review and discussion in terms of reflecting the Alameda decision in future valuation?
My understanding is that as part of the Alameda decision, those salaries that are referred to as terminal pay in the decision would not be counted possibly as pensionable compensation. However, my understanding also is that some clients and some employers do allow employers to basically allow the cash outs to happen during an employee's career, and those pays, and again, speaking based on an actuary's understanding of the law, those ongoing, not a spiking of salaries at towards the end of the employee's career would continue to be counted. My also understanding is that in the Alameda decision, they also talk about on-call pays, and again, if those on-call pays are available towards members' final average compensation period, maybe those salaries would not be counted. But whereas on-call pays that are available throughout the career might be includable. Suffice to say that it is a little bit too early. My understanding from talking to Sisera staff is that The case is being remanded to the trial court. I think there's a bullet that we have on page 9 of the report to that effect. But bottom line is that for the both the membership data as well as the financial data, the contributions, assets, and whatnot that we have used in the valuation, neither of those have been adjusted to anticipate the outcome of the final outcome of that Alameda decision and how that is going to impact CSERA. So at least for the valuation that we have just conducted with respect to the Alameda decision, I would say that everything is kind of status quo until we get further guidance and direction from the board as to how to make any changes, if any, with respect to either the contributions that employers and employees have paid, as well as liabilities that we are supposed to use or not use in our valuation.
So if I may interject, I don't want to speak to on-call because I don't know how that's running through this, but my understanding was with the 2013 valuation, we got rid of terminal pay for the most part. Isn't that correct? In fact, if you look at the value, like the table of amortization bases, if you see the 2013, there's a footnote on assumption change, and it said they were reduced to reflect AB 197.
Again?
Yep, that's true.
I don't know if that helps you, David.
Well, that actually sounds a little odd to make that adjustment with the pending decision that we just got back in 2013. I mean, I know that's kind of the direction that perhaps was anticipated, but to make actuarial changes based on that seems a little bit of a stretch because you don't know the outcome of the case yet. So,
but I think this is Paul again. I think back in 2013, you know, there were some elements that were still open to the courts, but there were some changes that were implemented. And so, you know, what we would have reflected in the evaluation 2013 would have been driven only by changes that were actually adopted and put into place in 2013. So I think there's a couple different terminal pay buckets here. And, you know, one was identified as no longer included in plan administration back in 2013, but some others were left open pending the judgment by the court. And that's why we still have that terminal pay assumption that you saw back in Section 4.
Oh, the leave cash-out assumption, right, Paul, you were thinking.
Leave cash-out assumption.
Well, so if the Supreme Court ruling was in favor of the employees, then that potentially could have made the unfunded liability worse, given the changes that you made back in 2013. So that's why I think that was a little bit of a risky move to do that. Still, okay.
Jerry?
Paul, it's not the number that makes all the difference, but it's one that gets a lot of attention. So could you comment on where we stand, I guess, comparatively with regard to funded status? It's or funded ratio, it's not one of the things that you've commented on. It gets a lot of press attention.
Right. As you know, I'm a funded ratio agnostic. I think it gets a lot of press attention because the press has a short attention span. Although I think that certainly compared to other plans around the country, Contra Costa doing remarkably well. Here's your funded ratio progression, and you broke the 90% level. I think this is an extraordinarily strong position to be in. I have to say this carefully. I was once quoted in the press as saying that plans should only aim toward 90% funding. I would never say such a thing. Your funding policy aims at 100% funding. But there is kind of a comfort zone when you get into the 90s. It means your unfunded is relatively small, but it also means you're not yet moving into surplus, and sometimes surplus can be a difficult policy area for boards to live. So I actually kind of like having plans kind of hang around in the 90s, even though your funding policy does target 100%. This is a very strong funded ratio nationally. I would also say even within California, we have other 37 Act plans that I think, Andy, are still in the 70s and 80s percent funded. So I think this is just remarkably strong. That said, there is no magic about the funded ratio. What matters is the unfunded in dollars, because that's what drives your employer contribution. So I tend to, you know, there's an urban myth out there, for example, that, you know, if you're below 80% funding, you're in trouble. If you're above 80% funding, you're okay. Well, that's not true. There's even an actuarial brief out there that talks about the 80% funding myth. So similarly, there's nothing magic that happens at 90%, but I think you're in a very fairly comfortable range. So what that means is your unfunded liability is relatively small, and that means that the compared to other plans, your contribution rates will not have the same level of unfunded requirement for your employer you might see elsewhere. So that's a big waffle, Jared. I think getting to 90% gives you bragging rights if you're in a room where people are talking about their funded ratio.
Yeah, and I think we haven't talked about that today with the board, but definitely we have a section in our report talking about what happens for a fund like ours where we have a funding ratio of 90%, which means 90 cents on the dollar. So now we have a lot of assets to back up that liability. So in the report, we have a section on the risk. We call that the assets volatility ratio. So for a plan like ours, which is marching towards that 100% funding status, we are currently at 90%. That means we have more assets. So in a year like where we were at in 2019, when the rate of return was almost 15%, that's a very good thing, right? Because we have a lot of we have a lot of assets to invest and get the 15% rate of return. But the flip side, of course, is true. If we ran into a difficulty and if the market misbehaved and did not return the 7%, then we are a little bit more vulnerable when compared to those plans that Paul was alluding to with only a 70% funded status. So on the one hand, we want to give ourselves a pat on the back because we are at 90, marching towards 100%. But of course, we have to be mindful that there could be difficulty, especially if the rate of return, actual market rate of return were to come in lower than what we would have expected.
This is a good thing. Andy, thank you for that. This is a good example of no good deed goes unpunished. The more money you have, the more you have to lose. So you actually will, as plans get closer to 100% funding, you will actually see higher contribution rate volatility from the investment side. The good years will look more good. The bad years will look more bad because your assets are larger in proportion to your payroll. So that's the downside. We worked on the two LA City plans. I think this was right before the 2008 downturn. You know, one of the plans was 90% funded. One of the plans was 70% funded. When the market went down, guess which plan got hurt harder? The better funded plan. So there is an additional volatility risk that comes with being closer to 100% funded. Thanks, Andy, for that.
Yeah, I think my point is, and you, without disparaging the press, because they're reflective, I think, of the public's interest sometimes too, they focus on a couple of specific points. They get those in their head, and the trend that is shown on this page, I think, that is currently displayed should not be ignored. What it means is I think that we're going to get less negative attention appropriately, even though this is not the only marker that we need to be concerned about. But when you look at a trend, an eight-year trend from 70% to 90%, it's not to be ignored.
That's absolutely true, Mr. Holcomb. Absolutely true. Especially since during that time, you strengthened your actual assumptions, you know, and even with the we see a lot of plans where even though the markets have been very strong the last few years, the funding ratio has stayed flat. That's because they're basically, every time they lower their expected return or lengthen their mortality table, they're basically spending those gains on stronger assumptions, if you will. What this shows here is at Contra Costa, even with your strengthening of assumptions, because you're right in the pack for your assumptions, even with the strengthening of assumptions, you've still seen positive growth. So I don't want to take that away at all, Jerry. You're absolutely right. And to see a plan go from 70% funded, and by the way, I can almost bet in 2012, there were some assumption changes. You see that drop of 78 down to 70? That's almost an outlier there. But if you take the 70s there, and like you said, over that 8-year period, you went from the low 70 or mid 70s to 90%. That is certainly something to, I like the way you put it, Jerry. It'll take some of the pressure off the plan, we would think.
Thanks. I would only add one other, if I could, Todd, just one little thing on that. Sometimes in discussions in the past, I'm beginning to show my age here badly, about sending out press releases to brag about numbers, good numbers. I'm suggesting we not do that. It's just nice to be in a position to be able to point them out if the questions are asked.
Jerry, you had me worried there for a second. I thought you were going to say this to a press release and say we broke 90. I was just saying,
no.
Yeah, but you're right. No, I went to 100%. 100%.
Any other trustee questions or comments? Okay. Andy, Paul, thank you so much for this presentation. And great work as always.